at NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, it's primary day in New York, and the high-profile Republican primary for Sullivan County Sheriff is filled with allegations and controversy. Plus, the $40 million Camp Fimfo campground development is still stirring environmental concerns in the town of Highland. River Reporter journalist Leah Mayo joins us to break down two of Sullivan County's most talked-about stories. New York's SUNY system is launching a game-changer for adult learners, free community college tuition through SUNY Reconnect. Radio Catskill's Genevieve Hartnett sits down with Sullivan President Dr. David Potash to discuss what this means for the state's educational future and locally. Plus, the Western Sullivan Public Library's Color Our World Summer Reading Program for all ages and creativity and community at the West Courtright Center. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Israel and Iran have both said they're observing a ceasefire. But Israel says Iran broke it earlier, something Iran denies. Israel says it carried out a limited strike near Iran's capital. President Trump lashed out at both Israel and Iran, saying he was not happy with either one of them. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, the president insists the ceasefire is in place, but it is fragile.
Expressing frustration with apparent violations of the ceasefire, President Trump used an expletive. U.S. presidents simply do not say on camera, quote, they don't know what the blank they're doing.
I think they both violated it. Yeah, I'm not sure they did it intentionally. They couldn't rein people back. I don't like the fact that Israel went out this morning at all. And I'm going to see if I can stop it.
A short time later, from Air Force One, he posted on Truth Social, Israel would not attack Iran, and all planes would turn around and head home. Further writing, nobody will be hurt. The ceasefire is in effect. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
Countries across the Middle East are welcoming the ceasefire announced by President Trump between Israel and Iran. This came after Iran launched missiles at U.S. troops stationed in Qatar. NPR's Aya Batraoui reports that was in response to the U.S. bombing of three Iranian nuclear sites last weekend.
The U.S. and Qatar were given prior warning by Iran of the incoming missile launch on El Alamein Air Base. Only 2 hours earlier, Qatar had closed its airspace. Qatari and U.S. forces intercepted the missiles, and there were no casualties from the attack. Brent crude had surged to nearly $78 a barrel in trading Monday over concerns about attacks in the Gulf, where much of the world's oil and gas is produced. But prices have since tumbled to below $70 a barrel on news of the ceasefire, which Trump says both sides already violated this morning. Meanwhile, there's still no sign of an imminent ceasefire in Israel's other war in the region, in Gaza. Health officials in Gaza say Israeli forces killed nearly 80 people in just the past 24 hours. Israel's military says some of those shootings are under review. Aya Batraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
In the U.S., the National Weather Service has posted heat advisories or extreme heat warnings across much of the central and eastern parts of the country. Temperatures could rise above 100 degrees from North Carolina right up to Maine's border with Canada. The heat is sweltering in cities. Forecasters say this poses a risk to seniors. A few thousand customers lost power yesterday in New York City. Robert Friedrich is the president of a local co-op that lost electricity and air conditioning.
We have a lot of seniors here who were just really sweating. They were upstairs. It was really very uncomfortable. It was really very dangerous.
Authorities are urging people in significant heat to seek other air-conditioned buildings. On Wall Street, stocks are higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 266 points. You're listening to NPR News. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell is testifying before a House panel this morning. He says the Fed will continue to wait to see how the economy behaves before acting on interest rates. President Trump has been criticizing Powell, demanding rate cuts. The City Council of Berkeley, California will meet today to discuss the city's rent prices. A ban on an algorithm that sets rent prices was supposed to take effect. From member station KALW, Jasmine Asensio reports the Berkeley City Council is weighing whether to delay that ban.
Berkeley voted in March to ban software that sets rent prices. The ban was set to begin at the end of April, but was temporarily put on hold when RealPage sued the city at the start of the month. RealPage is a Texas-based property management software company that uses AI and data to recommend rent prices. It says that the ban infringes on its First Amendment rights. Algorithmic software has been connected with rising rent prices throughout the country. California lawmakers have introduced bills to restrict landlords from using this software. San Francisco has a similar law that went into effect last fall. For NPR News, I'm Jasmine Asensio in San Francisco.
Today's primary day in New York City. The most watched contest is the Democratic primary for mayor. There are 11 candidates. Polling suggests a tightening race between former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and New York Assemblyman Zoran Mamdani. The sole Republican mayoral candidate is Guardian Angels founder Curtis Sliwa. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include EBSCO, supporting open source technology and making open platforms possible for libraries of all sizes. Learn more at EBSCO.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. It's primary day in New York State. Polls are open until 9 o'clock, and while a lot of the attention has been on the New York City mayoral race, the Republican primary for Sullivan County Sheriff has drawn intense public scrutiny, with incumbent Mike Schiff facing a challenge from former state police investigator Tim Diamond. The race has been marked by sharp allegations of misconduct, a public war of words, and an investigative report by the River Reporter that sparked further controversy. Meanwhile, in the town of Highland, years of debate over the proposed Camp Fimfo Resort campground are coming to a head. A final environmental impact statement is under review, with the local planning board weighing whether the $40 million project poses too great a risk to the community's environment, safety, and character. Joining us now is River Reporter journalist Liam Mayo, who's been covering both stories extensively. Liam, good morning.
Good morning, Tim.
Let's start with Camp Fimfo. We'll get to the primary in a minute here. Let's give folks a brief overview of Camp Fimfo and why it's drawn so much local attention.
Yeah, so the Camp Fimfo project initially came in 2022. This is a historic tenting campsite along the Delaware River, formerly known as, and actually currently known as, Kittatinny Campgrounds and Canoes. It was bought by a national chain developer, Northgate, and they are proposing to turn this campsite into Camp Fimfo, which is a brand they have a couple of other locations elsewhere. It's proposing to put like $40 plus million of renovations into the place. Some of those are just structural stuff, things that needed to be done anyways, upgrading sewer or septic systems. But then also part of it is changing the character of the site from being this historic, traditional tenting campsite to something a little more akin to glamping, with a lot of sort of stationary RVs that people can come and camp in. And this project has drawn a lot of heat from the community over the past three some years that it has been in development, just because people fear it would change the nature of the community. It's kind of a big development in an area that is fairly quiet, and people have concerns about how this will impact the environment. People have concerns about how this will impact the character of the local area. And where we've come to now is essentially a huge 400-page document that collects all of the community's concerns and requires those concerns to be answered. The final environmental impact statement just essentially lists all of the potential impacts that this could have on the environment and requires those impacts to be considered and to be mitigated. Where we're at right now is the developers behind Camp Fimfo have turned into the Highland Planning Board basically their responses to all of the concerns from the community. That's everything that's currently in that 400-page document. And over the next couple of months, the Highland Planning Board will be meeting in a series of workshops to go over the responses from the developers of the project and sort of take them one by one, review them, decide as a planning board if those responses adequately address the concerns of the community. And then if they don't, the planning board has the authority to basically like write their own responses, as the planning board will be the final authority issuing this environmental impact statement.
So the final environmental impact statement is there. It includes the concerns of the community, as you've mentioned, and the studies. In terms of environmental and safety concerns, what are the most contentious or unresolved issues identified so far?
I think it's hard to say what the most contentious things have been. Just because it's been such a
let's talk about some project. I don't want you to assign a rank to any of them necessarily, but let's just talk about some of the ones that have bubbled up. You've reported on concerns about emergency preparedness, especially related to flood zones. What are some of these things that have bubbled up, and what are the concerns that people are pushing back against?
Yeah, well, what I'll say is that our reporting so far, or on this most recent bit of the final environmental act statement, has been on just kind of a chunk of it, which is. The planning board is taking it in chunks. They did at the June 11 meeting that we reported on, they took the first 50-something pages, I think it was a little more than that, of this document to review. There will be, I think the next workshop meeting is going to be this Wednesday, where they're going to take the next chunk of that document. But the emergency services bit that you've mentioned is... one of those concerns that people have had throughout the process, that chunk of the document did kind of address, or that the planning board discussed in their review of it. People are concerned that the extensive nature of this project will put increased demands on the local emergency services. And according to the planning board, the Camp Fempo has agreed to make a couple of concessions to local emergency services to address that, and local emergency services are still kind of pushing for more. One of the stipulations that the planning board said has been agreed to is a $25,000 annual payment to kind of support the local emergency services. Highland EMS has additionally requested a 3% annual increase, as well as a certain amounts of training for Camp Fempo employees, and kind of a really set in stone emergency management plan, so that if there's an emergency situation or a medical situation in the campsite, Highland EMS will be able to come through and kind of find that person who's having the medical emergency.
The project team has also agreed not to apply for a payment in lieu of taxes. It's called a pilot agreement. What is that? Why is that significant in this?
Yeah, that's something where it came up kind of early on in the process, where they were looking for this agreement, which is kind of a tax incentive, where instead of paying sort of the normal property taxes, they would pay a predetermined amount to a broader agency that would then get like brought down to, or that would then get sent back down to the town. And this has been a concern for the community, just for reasons of fairness. Like, they think if this project is coming in and is going to make this much money off of this property, they should just be paying their regular property taxes. But in general, I think where we've gotten to is a place where all of those concerns can genuinely be really, really hashed out. The document that we have now, the final environmental impact statement, didn't need to exist. Through the initial period of the project, from basically September 2022 to September 2023, the board was considering like whether the project would have an environmental impact and whether they would need to kind of do this in-depth level of analysis onto it. And then in September 2023, the planning board did decide to require this environmental impact statement. And then the past like 2 years, 1.5 years since then, has been drafting this document. So I think it feels like a long time that this project has been being considered, and there have been points along the way where the Planning Board or the National Park Service or other organizations have asked for more information and sort of slowed down what could have been a more expedited planning process. But where we get to is this 400-page document that does adequately address, or in theory does adequately address, all of the concerns from the community and gives the Planning Board enough time to fully consider and fully weigh through all of the impacts that this significant development will have on the surrounding area.
One of the things that the community, folks in the community are raising is the number of visitors and the land use. Did the Planning Board discuss how to evaluate the expected numbers of visitors to Camp Vimpho, and how are they going to evaluate that?
Yeah, one of the bits of the environmental impact statement that they were looking to revise from what Vimpho had submitted is just how the number of visitors is calculated. Vimpho kind of used both a couple of different numbers for their expected visitors. And in the view of sort of a Planning Board discussion, the numbers were a little bit disingenuous because they were basically saying, well, if Camp Vimpho or Kitatinny Canoes previously had a certain percentage of occupancy, because we're reducing the number of campsites at this area, the occupancy will be reduced similarly. So because there are fewer campground sites in Camp Vimpho versus Camp Kitatinny Canoes, there will be fewer visitors to the site. And members of the sort of team that the Planning Board had brought together raised concerns that the use patterns will be different. So that's not an accurate way to estimate how many visitors you'll be bringing in, just because, you know, you'll get different use patterns for glamping, sort of more glamorous campsite compared to more of a tenting campsite. So that's one of the situations, or one of the parts, where the Planning Board expressed an interest in writing their own response and not relying on the developer's response.
So the draft final environmental impact statement has been submitted. It's available on the Town of Highland website. The Planning Board now has to review this. Did they indicate what the timeline is moving forward? I guess they're holding some workshops.
Yeah, they indicated that they would basically continue holding workshops until they fully reviewed the project, but they weren't expecting it to take more than a few months. They said that, you know, according to the, they said that there wasn't a like strict deadline baked into law for when they would need to have this process completed by, but that they did intend to do these workshops and to have this process done sort of in a timely fashion.
And is there any indication yet as to whether the Planning Board might ultimately approve, reject, or conditionally approve the project? Any sort of guess there that you could venture?
I would say that what it feels like we're going towards is conditional approval, with the conditions being everything that's laid down in the final environmental impact statement. Like, I think all of this consideration has been an attempt to really accurately name what the potential negative effects of this will be, so that when the Planning Board approves the project, they will have this document in place as kind of a legally binding thing, saying, okay, there is going to be this impact in terms of noise, in terms of impact to the environment, in terms of sort of septic implant or septic flow, in terms of the sort of physical campsites at the location. But there is this legal document, and there are these conditions that are placed as requirements on the developers of Camp Vimpho, so that those impacts are mitigated, or so that those impacts do not on the whole harm the town of Highland. So I would say that feels to be the direction that the Planning Board is going in.
you've been covering this for a while, the River Reporter covering it for a while all over. What are you watching most closely as this process unfolds? And is there anything people should be paying attention to, people in the region should be paying particular attention to?
I mean, I think it'll be interesting to see what happens with it when it's completed, if it eventually gets approved and eventually gets like built out. It'll be interesting to see how it impacts the local environment, a local economy. It'll be interesting to see how it impacts the character of the region. One of the things that was discussed sort of earlier on in the process is there's a belief in the industry that this is the future of camping, that there are fewer people who want that kind of traditional sleeping bag in the dirt camping experience, and that there is a broader market, and that the next sort of generation's market for camping is a little bit more high-end, is this kind of, you come to a sort of pre-established small cabin / mobile RV, or this like pre-constructed, slightly more glamorous tent, and you have a more comfortable experience. You are out in nature, but you also have your amenities. So it will be interesting to see if this is sort of an accurate read on their part. It'll be interesting to see whether that's kind of a model that spreads to broader, or like how that model spreads elsewhere in the Upper Delaware River Valley.
Let's take a quick break, and then we'll talk about another big story that you are covering in Sullivan County, which is the sheriff's race here. It's primary day in New York State, and that has been one of the, I would say, more contentious races. Let's take a quick break. We're talking to Liam Mayo, journalist from the River Reporter, and we'll be right back with more. It's Radio Chatskill.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, Austin Goolsbee, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, is less reserved than the average banker.
From the beginning, they started asking, are you a dove? Are you a hawk? I just want to be a data dog.
And how does a data dog see the Fed's role at this tense moment?
The Fed is not the bad guy. We are the guardians of the galaxy.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. This afternoon at 1 o'clock on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and we're speaking with Liam Mayo, journalist from The River Reporter, filling us in on the latest from the Camp FIMFO campground development there in the town of Highland. The other big story he's covering and The River Reporter is covering is that Republican primary for Sullivan County Sheriff. It's drawn a lot of attention. Today is New York primary day. Liam, can you walk us through who the candidates are here and why this race is so contentious?
Yeah, one of the candidates is current Sheriff Mike Schiff, longstanding sheriff in the county, sort of well-liked in the community, does like extensive community outreach stuff to, you know, engage with the community. The other is kind of a newcomer, a former New York State police investigator, Tim Diamond. He retired from the state police in January 2025, and has been running against Schiff since then, with kind of the case that there are issues in the sheriff's office that need to be addressed, and pitching himself as the person to address them.
There have been a lot of allegations back and forth from both camps. Your reporting had a detailed investigation back in February. You know, given the volume of this public discourse, both online, in print, what's the tone of the campaign been like from both camps and some of their supporters? It seems like it's been more personal than issue focused.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely been more personal than issues focused, to the point where I've seen some of the discussion in recent weeks be just a confusion about what issues the candidates, particularly Diamond, are running on outside of this discourse. Diamond kind of initially came in and initially announced his run during a January 16 public safety meeting at the Sullivan County Legislature, and during that announcement, he claimed that the office of the Sullivan County Sheriff is, quote, hostile, lacks protocol, and is under FBI investigation. And that's quoting from our reporting back in February. And it, things have kind of continued from there with Diamond making allegations of misconduct against the sheriff's office and with of Sheriff Mike Schiff making allegations against Diamond or making like sort of pushing back against some of the things that Diamond has saying, been saying and trying to discredit what he's saying.
The primary seems like it's not just about law enforcement, but seems to have become some sort of a referendum on the culture within the sheriff's department. Do you know how voters are responding and what folks are thinking or saying? Have you heard anything there?
I haven't heard anything specifically. I mean, I've seen, you know, the River Reporter has gotten a lot of mail over the past several months, both from people in support of Diamond and people in support of Schiff, but it's really hard to say what the general tone is outside of those sort of most hardcore supporters. And it's kind of a similar situation online where there's a lot of posts being made by both people in support of Schiff and people in support of Diamond, but it's really hard to get a sense for how that's actually going to translate to the ballot box, which kind of makes today exciting because it's we're just going to have to see how it goes.
Yeah. And then aside from the sheriff's race, there are a few smaller races in Sullivan County. Do you have a quick rundown of those?
Yeah, the sheriff's race is the only county-wide race, I believe, that's on the ballot. That's in the Republican primary. However, there are a couple smaller ones. The Fallsburg Republican primary has four candidates running for two seats on the county's Republican committee. Joseph Perello, Karen Perello, Jeff Weiner, and James Ginty. The Rockland Republican primary has two candidates running for one town justice position, Ellen Wood and Alexandra Vagone. And the Bethel Democratic primary has four candidates running for two seats on the town council, Cliff Manning, Nicole Newick, and Alexandra. Sorry, those I skipped back a little bit in reading through this. The Bethel Democratic primary has four candidates running for two seats on the town council, Cliff Manning, Nicole Newick, John Manick, and Paula Moss. And the Fallsburg Democratic primary has four candidates running for two seats on the county's Democratic committee, Nathan Steingart, Ira Steingart, Stanley Wagner, and Pamela Wagner.
And, of course, polls are up until 9 o'clock today in New York State. There are races throughout the state, and you can check your local county's website for the races and polling locations. We've been talking to Liam Mayo from The River Reporter. You can find his reporting at riverreporter.com, all about the Camp Finfo Project, the sheriff's race, and much more. Liam, you're staying busy. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
All right, we'll take a break, and when we come back, adults in New York State 25 to 55 can pursue their degrees without financial burden. Radio Catskills' Genevieve Hartnett sits down with SUNY Sullivan President Dr. David Potash to find out more. This is Radio Catskill.
Next time on the Retro Cocktail Hour, there's Hawaiian music blended with the Nashville sound. On the album Hawaii with a Bongo Beat. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music is always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale. Dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFRadio.org.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. With the cost of higher education increasing every year, New York State is taking the first step in making pursuing a degree more accessible and affordable. The SUNY system is launching the SUNY Reconnect program this fall, providing free community college tuition to adult learners between the ages of 25 and 55. Radio Catskill's Genevieve Hartnett spoke with Dr. David Potash, president of SUNY Sullivan, about investing in New York's future with education and preparing for the impact of cuts from the Department of Education.
SUNY Reconnect provides New York State residents ages 25 to 55 a free community college education. Free. That's like books, all that other cool stuff. Free. Totally free. For pursuing a degree in high demand fields. We're really excited and we're really, really interested in doing what we can to make it the best possible experience educationally and as a student experience for the adults who want to come back and join SUNY Sullivan.
So the high demand fields, what do you determine that as?
Well, that wasn't our call. That was the governor's call working with the legislature. But that includes everything in healthcare. For SUNY Sullivan, that's nursing, medical assistant, respiratory care. That's IT fields like computer programming and cybersecurity. That's education. We have an early childhood program. That's drug and alcohol dependency. We've got a program in that. And that's also green jobs. We've got a green construction technology position. Mm. Now, there's some other things that the state has made available that will work that are high demand fields that the college currently does not offer. We're going to start with the programs we have. Test the water, so to speak, see if there's demand, because we're not just interested in getting people letters after their name. We want them to get a job. So we work pretty closely with the Workforce Development Board, other county offices, and we're going to see after we start rolling out if there are other things that we need to change or offer so we can get more people better jobs.
Now, New York is not the first state to invest in tuition-free community college, and the SUNY Reconnect program is an expansion of the tuition assistance program that's already in place. How is the Reconnect program a step forward for other states and especially for New York?
Well, I would be talking without enough research to be really talk about the programs at various states. What I would say is particularly smart about SUNY Reconnect is the data tends to show that there are about 4 million New York State residents who do not have a degree. And getting an associate's degree, getting a college degree, but particularly associate's, is absolutely the best way to get yourself into a career path where you can make more money, do what you like doing, and get some gratification out of it. And part of what a community college's mission is really to serve the needs of the local community. What is important about this is it takes a lot of courage to come back to school, particularly as you get on, life gets complicated. There's a saying in higher education that life gets in the way. I don't know if it gets in the way, but we all have lives. The majority of SUNY Sullivan students, we did a survey in the fall, actually think of themselves as workers who go to school as opposed to, yes, I'm just going to go to school and occasionally work part-time. Mm-hmm. By zeroing in on adults, those 25 or older, what that does is it provides a structure and a focus. So the college has an obligation then to follow up and to meet those students' demands in different kinds of ways and change our needs. Because these are not 18-year-olds coming fresh out of high school. These are people who often have children, who have other types of obligations. And the program, by focusing in that way, really carves out a space. It opens up a new door, so to speak.
So this program is for adult learners 25 to 55 and going for an associate's degree. Do you think sometime down the line, 5-10 years, maybe even longer, that this kind of program would work for all undergraduate seekers in New York State? And is there any steps that Governor Kathy Hochul is taking to make that happen?
That's a good question. I do not know the governor's agenda well enough to speak to that. What New York State recognizes is that an investment in higher education and making it more accessible, more affordable, is kind of like an investment in the state's future. When I talk to nursing students or when we have a ceremony for nursing graduates, we just did earlier in May, and you look at them, You think 10 years down the road, those are the folks who are going to take care of you. Those are the folks who are going to give your kids their shots. They're mm-hmm. going to fix them when they get banged up playing some sport. They're the ones who are going to take care of your relatives or your neighbors when there's an issue. And seeing them, you know, smiling at those moments, that's also like a window in the future about the people who are going to be part of the community doing really important work. Mm. And when you think about this kind of program, well, they may not be 19 or 20, maybe a little older, but you could see that they follow through. We do our job at the college. That's a window on a better future.
On a related point, there are some people who say that this will be an added cost on taxpayers. Can you also clarify where the financial support for the program is coming from?
Well, sure. This is what's called a last dollar scholarship. Mm-hmm. If you think about different types of scholarship opportunities, the federal government provides Pell on the basis of financial need. New York State provides TAP, Tuition Assistance Program, on the basis of need. We work very hard to make sure, for example, tuition at SUNY Sullivan is below those thresholds so that if there's documented, demonstrated need that follows like all the federal guidelines, someone coming to the college, it's going to be free. What this program does, and folks, they ran the numbers, they did all the calculations, they looked at the opportunity, they looked at the cost. As a last dollar scholarship, depending on how many students, the gap, the delta, the difference is not particularly overwhelming. The costs of not having an employee in a high demand field like medical assistants or nursing or respiratory care or computer programming, that can have a direct impact on the state's budget. It can have a direct impact on an individual, a family's health. If you stop investing in people, some folks get through, but a lot of folks, they don't get to that next step, and everybody kind of suffers.
On the federal level, do you foresee any difficulties with the mounting and advancement of this program in the face of the significant staffing cuts to the Department of Education?
Figuring out what's going to happen in D.C. in the next year or two. The SUNY system is really, really well plugged in. The information sharing within SUNY and really within higher ed is very, very good. So we make plans. A, B, C, D. Sometimes in certain environments with lots of changes, you add a lot of letters. Mm-hmm. So you got a lot of contingencies. What I think is important for the general public to know is that whatever happens, SUNY Sullivan and really basically all of SUNY, our mission is really about educating people. Educating people is ambitious enough.
Is there anything our listeners and other New Yorkers can do to make sure this program is stable in the future, or who would just maybe like to participate in it?
Well, I would really encourage everyone to look at the SUNY Sullivan website. Super easy to find to do it. I think if someone is interested, reach out. We'll talk to you. We'll talk about the program. We'll talk about what your needs are. Give us a call. We'll talk to you. It may not be the right thing for August, but it might be the right thing for January. That's like totally fine. We're not going anyplace. The idea in large part is to let everybody know if this might spark an interest for themselves, for a family member now, in the not too distant future. We'll share information. We'll see what we can do. And the more that people let us know that they might have an interest, they might have a question, might have a concern, the better we're going to be informed to tailor those programs so that we can make things more accessible and easier.
Thank you so much. And we've been talking with Dr. David Potash. He's the president of SUNY Sullivan.
Thank you so much, Genevieve. Really appreciate the time.
In Liberty, I'm Genevieve Hartnett for Radio Catskill.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, the Western Sullivan Public Library's Color Our World Summer Reading Program for all ages. That's next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hi, I'm Kusar Grace KG, host of the Music Emporium. 2 hours of great music right here on Radio Catskill. Sometimes I start out with a little bit of talk concerning things in the world for the week. Then I jump into some tunes that you will enjoy. Jazz, funk, blues, and more. So come and hang out with me. The Music Emporium. Tuesday night, 7 to 9, right here on Radio Catskill.
Hi, this is Marco Werman, host of The World. Weekdays at 3, our newsroom connects you with events around the globe. Our reporters in the Americas, Africa, Europe, and Asia get to the heart of the day's news. We bring you international perspectives on issues worldwide and here in the U.S. It's 1 hour each day that broadens horizons and takes you beyond our borders. Join me on The World, afternoons at 3, on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. This summer, the Western Sullivan Public Library is inviting readers of all ages to color our world with programs ranging from story times and paint parties to life-size games and movie nights. The library's 2025 Summer Reading Initiative is all about creativity, self-expression, and community. The season kicks off July 1st, and Callison Stratton from WSPL is here to tell us more about what's in store and how families can get involved. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, Tim. How are you?
Good. How are you? To color my world. What inspired this theme? How does it connect with the variety of programs you've planned for all ages?
So Color Our World is the theme that is collectively chosen by the Collaborative Summer Library Program, which is a national organization that brings all of the libraries together for like a connective theme. So a lot of the libraries in our region and across the country are going to be participating in this theme. But every individual library is encouraged to sort of do their own take on it. And so the way we envisioned it was to have 6 weeks of programming with each week focusing on a different artistic medium. So every week we'll have kids programs, teen programs, and adult programs that are all focused on the different themes of, they'll have the opportunity to do focused on visual art and painting, 3D art, multimedia, music and performance, writing and storytelling. So you'll see programs across all of those themes throughout the summer.
So what does that mean to you, exploring all the different ways to express yourself through art this summer?
Well, to me, I think it's a really wonderful way for kids to learn about their own self-expression and sort of dabble in the different things that get them excited about expressing themselves, and also building really strong connections with their local public library and seeing all the different ways that the library can support all of their expressive, their creative dreams. And the library has so many resources to support that, and our programs are really just one branch of that.
So let's talk about some of those special events that you've got coming up, some things that you're excited about. You've got everything from mimes to a community paint party, art party. Children's paint party.
We've got a lot going on. So our summer kickoff will take place at the Delaware Youth Center, as always, on Tuesday, July 1st at 10:30. We are being visited by the fabulous children's entertainer, David Engel, who is putting on Mr. Wonka's Wonder Show. And he always puts on a really fantastic show.
That Wonka.
Got it. And so it's going to be this really big, colorful, interactive event for kids to really get excited about kicking off the summer. We have Tuesday programs at the Delaware Youth Center all from July 1st through August 9th. And we're going to be having all of their Tuesdays will be hosted by us at the library. We've got special presenters, and also me and some other WSPL staff will be helping the kids get excited and do fun activities there as well. The other wonderful things we've got going on, we have Robert Rivest, who is a mime and storyteller, who will be at the Calicoon branch on July 10th at 1 p.m. And that's also an interactive sort of self-expressive social emotional learning kind of event, and where the kids will get to participate. They'll learn how to do a lot of self-expressive theater and improv. So that'll be really, that's going to be a fun one too. And then our community art party is an opportunity to bring everybody together. We're going to have some live musical performances, myself included, also Nick Rose of the Berryville Area Arts Association, and we're collaborating on that. We'll have members of the National Park Service doing a little station on wildflower pressing, and we'll have different art stations where people can try out different various art mediums. And then we'll also do a big community project where we're all going to put together a mural together.
Oh, do you know where the mural's going to be yet?
We're working on the base design, but it's kind of the idea is color our county.
Oh.
And we're trying to get everybody to sort of contribute to one singular vision. So that'll be really fun.
You've also got a strong lineup of programs for older kids and teens.
Yes.
There's a podcasting group, book clubs, even a Dungeons and Dragons group. Why is it important to include these age groups in your programming as well?
Well, I'd say it's one of the most important things to do is to engage our teens in our area, because a lot of the time, I think this is that's the time in our lives where we are most seeking out the ways that we connect with the world and the way that we express ourselves. And so we wanted to have a broad variety of ways for kids to sort of dabble and try different workshops. We're going to have a songwriting workshop, a poetry workshop with Kevin Scott Graham, who's the Sullivan County Poet Laureate. We're going to do zine making, nature photography, and book clubs. All of these are ways for kids to come into the library, connect with each other, and sort of maybe learn a new craft or hone a craft that they're already connected to. And hopefully, you know, that will help to find some sort of path forward with connecting with the library and finding a way to express themselves.
Well, and no matter how old the children are, the kids are, you got to incentivize them somehow. So you've got some kind of clever incentives here to get folks involved. What's the reading tracker, and what are some of the prizes you have to motivate kids and adults to read over the summer?
So we do have reading trackers for kids, and then we also have like a game board for adults, so that they, if they want to participate, they can go into any of our branches, Calicoon, Narrowsburg, and Jeffersonville, and pick up a reading tracker if you're under 18 and a game board if you're over 18. And we've got lots of activities. You can also get points for attending programs. And we're encouraging our kids to track their reading in increments of 15 minutes at a time. And when they turn in a reading tracker, a completed one, they get to pick a prize from one of our baskets. We'll have a little prize basket for them. And so if you're curious, you can always just go and take a look at the prize basket and say, oh, what can I get? And then our top five readers at the end of the summer, whoever turns in the tracking sheet with the most amount of points accumulated, will get a really nice big prize with a nice little goodie bag with a commemorative t-shirt, and they'll get some really special little things. And we are also going to have a prize wheel at a lot of our events. Not all of them, but at a lot of our events, we'll have a prize wheel so kids can come and spin the prize wheel and take home something special.
Where can folks get more information about the reading program and everything that you guys are doing?
Our website, WSPLonline.org. People can also sign up for our mailing list. I just started a brand new youth newsletter for WSPL with all of our upcoming youth programs. So if you're more specifically focused on finding some opportunities for your young people to get involved this summer, all of our programs are completely free and open to the public. And so you can go on our website, WSPLonline.org, sign up for our newsletter. You can also reach out to me, WSPL.children@gmail.com, and I can answer any of your questions.
And before we go, you wanted to make sure folks know about the community survey you've got.
Yes. So our community survey, we are trying to plan for our next 5 years. Every 5 years, we put out a community survey and try to get feedback on our library hours, our programming, our services, our offerings, our collections. And so our survey is available on our website, but you can also find them at your local post office in the region. We've got stacks of them in Peck's and Pete's and all of the different places where you can go shop. And you can also find them at our library branches. And your feedback is incredibly important to us because we really take it seriously. And we want to find out what the library means to you and what we can offer to incentivize you to come to the library.
Allison Stratton from the Western Sullivan Public Library. When she's not coloring our world, she's hosting Liberation Station Saturday nights at 7 here on Radio Catskill. Be sure to check it out. Allison, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll find out more about the connection and creativity at the West Courtright Center in Delaware County. This is Radio Catskill.
I'm Ira Flatow. On Science Friday, we wonder about the secrets of nature and meet the scientists finding the keys to the universe, like black hole maven Jan 11.
I think it's really important as a scientist not to put a belief system first. The whole point is to explore the unknown.
Come explore with us. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios. Fridays, 2 to 4 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
Hey, this is Matt Hurtado. Join me for Virtual Soundscapes, your gateway to the best music in gaming. Classic tracks from the 8-bit era, modern releases, and interviews with the minds behind the games. Thursday night at 10 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Since 1850, the building that now houses the West Courtright Center in Delaware County has stood as a cornerstone of community life. Originally a Presbyterian church for over a century, the historic Greek Revival structure was saved by local residents in 1975 and transformed into a vibrant nonprofit arts center. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke to Avery Bray, general manager of the West Courtright Center, to talk about the center's history and its ongoing role in the community.
Hello, Avery, and welcome to Radio Catskill and to our studio here in Liberty, New York.
Thank you.
You've enjoyed the tour around, I hope.
I really enjoyed the tour. That was fascinating.
Yes, and Jason's quite the tour guide.
Yeah.
And he knows a lot.
Yeah.
It is a labor of love. Now, you're involved in another labor of love, well, two really, but what we're here to talk about first is the West Courtright Center in East Meredith, New York.
Correct.
Down in the valley in Delaware County.
That's right.
Not far from the Book Village and Stamford, where Headwaters is. That's part of Roxbury Arts.
That's right.
So got a lot of art and culture going up there. We'll begin by talking about the center, which was established in 1975. Prior to that, it had been a Presbyterian church for over 100 years.
That's right.
Which was built in 1850 and is on the historic register.
Yeah.
So you're here to tell us about the center and what's going on. You offer a broad, broad range of events and performances, exhibits, and when I say from all around the world, I'm not kidding.
Yeah, that's right.
So tell us what's coming up.
One of our really popular workshops is a basket weaving workshop, and it sells out almost as soon as it gets posted. And then we have a stone wall building workshop, which there's still some spaces. And part of offering workshops that we have is we started a new concert series this season called Second Sundays. So it's easy to remember. It's always the second Sunday of every month from May through October. And it's a free afternoon show that we include workshops in. So the two that we've done so far, we had an indigo dyeing workshop and we had a paper marbling workshop at this last one. So yeah, we try to really offer as many enriching activities for the community as we can.
And you also do a lot with youth.
Yes, that's right. We have our Shakespeare program. So that goes all the way through July. And this year is going to be a production of Romeo and Juliet. And I don't remember. It's been going on for decades at the West Courtright Center, and it's a real institution. And we've divided it up into different levels with different age groups. And so you start off with the really small children doing an indoor production, and then all the way up to kids up to the age of 17 or 18 in the main Shakespeare production. And we're also offering a filmmaking workshop with that program. And you can be part of costuming and you can be part of the theater tech to put on the staging and the lights and sound and all of that. And it's a really amazing program that's been going on for a long time.
Yes, Shakespeare in the Valley.
Shakespeare in the Valley.
Well, you must have a lot of willing and active volunteers.
We do. We wouldn't be able to do what we do without our volunteers. And I'm in touch with a lot of them all the time, and we get people set up to do our concessions and to run the box office And when we have a larger program coming up, they'll help with parking and, you know, everything. So the full-time staff at the West Corey Center is just myself and the director, Sarah McLaren. So,
and you are general manager?
I'm the general manager. That's right.
And how long have you been at that?
So I've been the general manager since February. However, I've been the lighting director there, and this is my 32nd season doing lights.
Wow.
So I've been there since 1993.
You go way back.
I do.
Like us with WJFF.
You know, so I was in my early 20s and had done some community theater. And so I met someone who does the technical end of things, and he had – his name was David Kirchlich, and he had – built the stage, the current stage that we're using at the West Corey Center, and the lighting system. And he asked if I would help with the lights, and I said, sure. And so 93 was my first season, and I just stayed. And I'm very fortunate to be able to see all of the amazing programming that we've had at the West Corey Center. And an interesting little caveat to that is, so this season, as the general manager, I'm not able to be in the light booth and run the lights. But my son took over for me, and he is the same age that I was when I started. So he's 23, and I was 23 when I started. So that was just kind of a nice little thing. And so my son, Caden Bray, has been helping with the – and he's been doing that for years. He does like it. And my other son, Kian, also.
Well, that's a beautiful story of community and commitment.
Thank you. Yeah, the artists that we have there, they'll play at Carnegie Hall before they come up, and then they'll play with us, and they'll travel to Boston, or they'll go to Europe. So we have the highest level of performances available in the middle of these farms.
For our listeners, what is the website?
The website is westkc.org.
Westkc.org. It's the West Courtright Center.
That's correct.
If you Google that, you'll get there also. Yep. Yeah. Well, this has been wonderful speaking with you, but before we go, we'll just briefly talk about your other endeavor. Yeah. Is you're starting an independent radio station up in Stamford.
Yeah, so my best friend had this idea to start a radio station. Her name's Eva Green, and I got involved with that maybe almost 2 years ago now. And we were able to acquire a FCC license for a low-power FM station. And everything about what we're up to is at thepull.org.
The pull, P-U-L-L.
P-U-L-L. So sort of the magnetic pull to draw people in. And it's a community arts space and organization. And I'm very fortunate because we're able to collaborate with the West Courtright Center, obviously. And we have our studio space and office space, but also a performing venue and a workshop venue in the village of Stamford. So we are in the midst of fundraising now. And if you go to thepull.org, you'll be able to find links to programming that we already have online. We have many, many, many hours of community members will put together a playlist and come do a show. And we have some really great interviews. We did an interview last night with a town supervisor in the town of Stamford. So that's the other project that worked.
Well, good for you.
Thank you. And it's been fascinating to see what you have going on here.
Well, as you said, it takes a community to do it.
That's right.
Is there anything else you would like to add before we conclude?
Yes, I would like to thank the sponsors of the West Courtright Center. And they are Catskill Country Living, Clark Sportsfield Specialties, Good Sheep Food, Mimish, and our programs are supported by the New York State Council of the Arts, the O'Connor Foundation, and the Robinson Broadhurst Foundation.
Okay. Well, we've got to say thank you to those that help us keep the lights on.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Well, thank you again.
You're welcome.
Thanks to culture reporter Valerie Manzi for that report. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. New York primary day is today. Polls are open until 9. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com.
The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Have you heard what your neighbors are saying about the threat to public media?
I think that's totally unacceptable.
WJFF connects our whole community together.
We depend on truth, we depend on accuracy, and we depend on fair press.
I'm definitely protesting against any cuts to our local station.
Public radio is under threat, and the stakes have never been higher. Visit protectmypublicmedia.org and tell Congress to protect Radio Catskill while there's still time.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill. Heat advisory still in effect, high 93. Thunderstorms tomorrow, little relief.